Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we will take you to the University of New England in Westbrook for an address from author and environmentalist Bill McKibben. His talk is entitled Local and Global, Notes from the Frontlines of the Climate Fight. McKibben is the author of 15 books, most recently Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, and is the leader of the environmental group 350.org. He has written for The New York Times, National Geographic, Rolling Stone, and was a staff writer for The New Yorker in the late 80s. He is also the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College in Vermont. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience, or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Anwar Majid, Director of the Center for Global Humanities at the University of New England.
Good evening. Welcome to members of the Center for Global Humanities and members in this audience and folks watching us throughout the state. I am Anwar Majid, and the Director of the Center for Global Humanities at the University of New England. If you're like me and take our speaker, Bill McKibben's message to heart, I want to remind all of you that our center, with its dedicated staff who have made this event possible tonight, is committed to building a better community through the power and joy of ideas. We are transmitting this event live to libraries in Lewiston, Belfast, Holton, Bangor, and our own Portland Public Library. I am also glad to be able to bring you Bill McKibben to the stage. For a while, between his activism and the demands of the media, I wondered. But no, he is here, as you probably already saw. Bill is, as you know, the author of a dozen books about the environment, beginning with The End of Nature, which was published in 1989, which is regarded as the first book for a general audience on climate change, and his moving manifesto, Deep Economy, published in 2007. He is a founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org and has coordinated more than 15,000 rallies in at least 189 countries since 2009. Time magazine called him the planet's best green journalist. And the Boston Globe said in 2010 that he was probably the country's most important environmentalist. Mr. McKibben is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College and holds honorary degrees from a dozen of colleges, including the Universities of Massachusetts and Maine, the State University of New York, and Whittier and Colgate Colleges. In 2011, he was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We have no better guide to the state of our planet today, nor a better defender of what's left of our chances in these turbulent times than Bill McKibben. Please give him your warmest welcome, your best ears, and your strongest support. Bill McKibben.
Thank you very much. I can't actually see a damn thing, so I just assume you're out there. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight. First of all, it's a real pleasure to be in this grand schoolhouse. What an amazing place this is, and also to be talking over the computer to Belfast and Bangor and Lewiston and Holton. I've been to all those places, even to Holton, and this is a very good low-carbon way of getting around Maine. It's a gorgeous school, and it's a beautiful night. It almost looks like one of the first real winter nights, you know. It was so beautiful to see the snowbanks and that nice sunset and the smoke rising straight up out the chimneys into the windless night, and all feels right with the world, which makes me feel all the guiltier for the kind of realization that my kind of job is to be a professional bummer outer of people. And I apologize for that in advance, and I will try to end on a hopeful note. But first, we are going to go through the valley for a little while on the theory that I know you all know about climate change and global warming, but understanding exactly where we are and the depth of the problem is pretty important for understanding the scale and size and pace of the kind of measures we need to take to cope. So that's where I'll start. I wrote the first book about global warming now 23 years ago in 1989. And at the time, we actually knew most of what we needed to know about climate change. We know that when you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon into the atmosphere, and we knew that the molecular structure of carbon traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. Only thing we didn't really know then was how fast and how hard this was going to pinch, and the truth is it's pinching a lot harder and a lot faster than we thought it was going to. Partly that's because scientists, by their nature, are very conservative and always underestimate rather than overestimate. But I think more it's because of the psychological difficulty of understanding that things could really change. Human civilization evolved during the last 10,000 years in the period we call the Holocene, and it was a period of great stability. The atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide stayed at about 275 parts per million, give or take 5 or 10 parts per million during that period. And as a result, we think the temperature stayed pretty darn stable too. Roughly globally average, someplace around 59 degrees. But the carbon concentration of the atmosphere is not at 275 anymore. Ever since the Industrial Revolution started and we started burning all that old biology and throwing all that carbon up in the air, the number has been going up. It stands today at about 392 parts per million and rising about 2 parts per million per year. That's already increased the temperature about 1 degree of the planet. And we're pretty sure that there's another degree in the pipeline from carbon we've already emitted. The ocean holds the heat for a while, but not for very long. Now, 1 degree doesn't actually sound like all that much. I mean, if it was, you know, 30 degrees when we walked in here and 29 when we walk out, no one will be able to tell the difference. It turns out, though, that the planet can tell the difference. It adds up to about 0.75 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface of extra solar energy. And that turns out to be enough to make very large changes. What do I mean? Well, everything frozen on Earth is melting and precipitously. I can't tell you, probably everybody here is younger than I am, but the there might be one or two people out there who can remember those first pictures that came back from Apollo 8 of the Earth, you know, this blue-white marble floating in the black void, and they were very beautiful pictures, and they are as out of date as my high school yearbook picture is, because since 1968, we've lost about 40% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. The Earth does not look that way anymore. The seas themselves are about 30% more acid because chemistry of seawater changes as it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. That's an enormous effect. Maybe the most pronounced thing that we've seen in the last few years, and the one I'll just concentrate on for a moment, is changes in the Earth's hydrological cycles, the way that water moves around the planet. And these are driven by a simple fact, maybe the most important fact for understanding the century that's coming at us now, which is that warm air holds more water vapor than cold air does. So the atmosphere is about 4% wetter on average than it was 40 years ago, and that is an astonishingly large change in a basic physical phenomenon, one we think stayed more or less stable for that period of the Holocene. But the Holocene is over. We've moved out of it in the lifetime of the people in this room into some new thing. And one of the features of that new thing is this much wetter atmosphere. It means that we've loaded the dice for drought and for flood, and we're seeing both in amazing numbers. Last year, 2011, in the U.S., the meteorologists have just sort of finished totting up the figures, is that by far the most extreme weather year for which we have records. That is, a much higher number of states of the Union in condition of either flood or drought in the course of the year than we've ever seen before. The numbers and the images are really pretty startling. Think about that drought across the American Southwest, Oklahoma and Texas. A drought so deep that it was drier and hotter than the Dust Bowl years. It never had been, and there's never been hotter summers measured on this continent than the ones that Oklahoma and Texas endured. And as a result, we saw more acreage burned across the Southwest in wildfire than ever before. And really, it was almost otherworldly. The chief of the Texas Forest Firefighting Service, one day in September, when there were huge blazes killing people and taking out large parts of the suburbs around Austin, he said, "No human being has ever fought fire in conditions like this before." And he was more or less correct. The humidity was all but nil, and the temperature was setting records. It's things like that that caused me to title this last book of mine with that odd title, Earth, misspelled with the extra A. You kind of have to channel your inner Schwarzenegger to pronounce it correctly. So, but that's what I was talking about. A planet, it kind of looks like the one we were born onto, same number of continents, gravity still works, but in fundamental ways, it's begun to shift around us. And of course, the mirror image of drought is flood. Once that water's up in the air, it's coming down. Water vapor molecule only on average stays in the atmosphere less than a week. So the dice is loaded for flood, too. And boy, did we see that in this country this past year. In the spring, the Missouri and the Mississippi were carrying more water than they've ever carried before. We had to keep blowing up levees to save cities. That's because we had record snowpack. That's what happens when you have record rainfall and the temperature is below 32 degrees. And then as it melted, we had record rainfall in that Mississippi basin. And when that was done, the flooding continued with wild, unprecedented rainstorms in place after place after place. My home state of Vermont got its taste in late August when Hurricane Irene came up the East Coast. And you'll remember watching Irene make its way up. It wasn't that powerful a storm. Its winds weren't that high. But as it came over the ocean off New York and New Jersey, it encountered record high sea surface temperatures. And that allowed it, like a sponge, to just soak up water. And then it carried it and it dumped it, a lot of it, on Vermont. And the state darn near washed away. The town next to mine, they were dropping food by helicopter for a week because the roads were all gone and the bridges were all gone. And to understand, I can give you the statistical, explain it two ways. Maybe you saw the pictures from that of covered bridges that had been there for 200 years, taking whatever nature could throw at them, washing away down rivers. That tells you something different was going on. And the statistics tell you the same thing. We have 200 years of rainfall records in New England, more really. That means there have been tens of thousands of rainstorms. And that means, for those of you who have ever studied statistics, that if you were, it'd be very difficult to set a new rainfall record given all those precedents. But if you did, the record should come by a millimeter, you know, an eighth of an inch, some tiny increment. That's how it should work. We broke one-day rainfall records across Vermont by 25 and 30%. A week later, when Tropical Storm Katie came up a little bit further west, Binghamton, New York, broke its one-day 200-year-old rainfall record by 60%. That's what I mean when I say we're on a new planet that doesn't work the way that we're used to it working. And of course, in Vermont or in Texas or in Mississippi, we still have enough money to deal with this kind of thing. Exactly the same thing is going on in the rest of the world, someplace every day, and often in places that do not have the money to even begin to deal with it. So there's horrible drought right now underway, absolutely epic and record drought across the Horn of Africa in places like Somalia. There have been failed harvests all over the world the last 2 years, which have caused the price of grain to spike 60 and 70% and increased the roster of malnourished and hungry people by a couple of hundred million. There's flooding of epic proportions someplace almost every week. The most amazing pictures in the last few months came from Thailand, from Bangkok, record rainfall. And this is, you know, not some backwater place. Bangkok's one of the great cities on earth, a kind of cradle of Buddhist civilization, and it was underwater. And by the time they'd added up all the damage in Thailand from that flood, it had equaled 18% of the country's gross domestic product. That means in economic terms, it was 25 times more damaging to Thailand than Hurricane Katrina was to the United States. As far as anybody can tell, there's never been a natural disaster that took out that share of a country's economy quite like that. I could obviously go on listing things like this all day, and I won't. The things I want you to understand are that we're still in the relatively early stages of global warming. That is, the damage described so far can and will get much, much worse. We've raised the temperature 1 degree. The climatologists who've been right about everything so far are pretty clear that unless we get off coal and oil and gas very, very fast, far faster than any government's planning to, that number will be 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out, and most of that will be locked in the next little while. And there is no reason at all to think that we can deal with 4 or 5 degrees. In fact, the agronomists, a big team at Stanford and University of Washington, published a paper last year saying, from this point on, every degree increase in global average temperature should decrease grain yields about 10%. And we're, as I say, starting to see that with these bad harvests. Try to do the kind of mental math in your head. Take what you know about the world and then imagine it with 20 or 30% fewer calories, and then try to figure out what development looks like and what women's rights look like and what public health looks like and what war and peace looks like. We can't let this happen. We cannot let this happen. It's the most important challenge by far that human beings have ever faced, and we've got to get to it, and that's what I want to talk about. Part of the response is to make our lives and our communities more resistant to the change that's coming, and in the process make them, in fact, much more ecologically sound and less a cause of this problem. And that's a very good thing to do, and we can see it starting to happen in local ways that are really beautiful. And I know that Maine's been leading in some of these. Maybe the most obvious, it's what's been going on with local agriculture in the last little while, watching the rise of the farmers market and things over the last 15 years has been a great pleasure. It's the fastest growing part of our food economy, local agriculture. It's now reached the point of real meaning. Last year, the United States Department of Agriculture reported that for the first time in 150 years, there were more farms in America instead of fewer. And that's really good news. And it means that, you know, one of the deep demographic trends in our society has bottomed out and reversed. And it's good news for many reasons. So the farmer's market is a beautiful symbol of all kinds of things. It's obviously ecologically sounder. The 5-mile tomato makes more sense than the 500-mile tomato. It's obviously culinarily sounder. I came 500 miles yesterday. I know what I feel like. That's what the tomato feels like also, you know. But more to the point, it's also just sort of socially sounder. A couple of years ago, a pair of sociologists followed shoppers, first around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. Y'all have been to the supermarket, you know how it works. You walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance, you visit the stations of the cross around the market. That's about it. When they followed shoppers around the farmer's market, they had on average 10 times as many conversations per visit. They were re-knitting back together the kind of communities that we've allowed to atomize and divide and fragment in the era of high consumer hyper-individualism that we've been living through. So that kind of work is really important, and all of us should be called to it. And you can figure out all the many ways. Most of my writing in recent years has been about just that kind of work. And it's not just food, it's energy and it's finance and it's all the things that we can put on a new footing, all the things that we can take out of the category where they now are too big to fail and put them in the category of small enough to make sense, you know? And that's really good work. And I wish that that was the only work that I do, because there's really nothing I'd rather do than stay home in Vermont and work. It's very good to be with you all here tonight. But I like stay at home. Everybody likes stay at home. I've hardly been at home the last couple of years. I got an email in October from my wife saying, "You do know that you've spent more nights in jail than you have at home this year, don't you?" And I was like, it's not really the kind of note you want to get from your wife. But the reason that I'm on the road all that time is because if we cannot solve this larger climate crisis, then what we do locally will in the end not matter. And boy, did I get a sense of that when Hurricane Irene roared through Vermont, because Vermont's done at least as much as Maine with local food. There's very few places that have tried to build and successfully built that gorgeous local agricultural infrastructure, and a hell of a lot of it washed away. The Intervale Farms in Burlington, maybe the showpiece of Vermont, 120 acres used to be the kind of informal dump in Burlington. There's now 10 farms there, nonprofit. Young farmers go there for 3 years and get a start and build a market and learn their craft and are mentored. And it's a glorious place, and it provides about 10% of the fresh food that Burlington eats, okay? But not this year. The Winooski rose and it covered the entire place and nobody harvested a blessed thing. And there are farms all across the state where the topsoil is now covered with sand from the river. It's a sad and powerful sight to see, and a reminder that we also have to be at work on this larger scale doing something to get the planet set right. What to do about it? I'm not even going to talk about the technologies that we need, because that's the easy part and the part we've really done some work on. 20 years ago when environmentalists talked about wind and sun, we did it with our fingers crossed. This stuff was not quite ready for prime time, It was sort of still the province of aging hippies down in the basement with their array of lead acid batteries, and they were the great pioneers. But now it's not like that at all, Now it's simple as can be. We know how to do this stuff. We're just not doing it. Let me tell you a story to illustrate what I mean. I was in China last year finishing a piece for the National Geographic about energy in China. And China's doing a lot of things wrong. They're building a lot of coal-fired power plants and emulating what we did. They'll never catch up to us as per capita emitters of carbon, but they're giving it their best shot. But they're also building an awful lot of green power, and they're leading the world in that. And one of the most visible and important elements and simple elements of that is what they've done with solar hot water. These solar hot water heaters, which are very simple and basic, are on the roofs of about 60 million buildings in China. When 250 million Chinese take a shower, the hot water is coming from solar panels on the roof. In this country, the number is way less than 1% of people. And not because they don't work. They work fine in Vermont, where I live, at that latitude. They'd work fine here. They work fine anywhere. But we just don't do it because we're, well, here's the punchline to this story. I spent the day with the guy who built the largest of these solar hot water firms, a thing called Heemin Solar, and we had a wonderful talk together for a couple of hours, an interview, and then he said, as I was leaving, he said, come into my little private museum. This guy, not surprisingly, is very rich. And there, you know, the museum was kind of odd. There were sort of like busts of great men of history, you know, Voltaire and Rousseau and things. But in the middle of it, there's this old sort of rusting solar panel, solar hot water panel. He says, you know what that is? I said, no, I don't know what. He says, that's one of the solar panels that Jimmy Carter put on the White House in 1979 and Ronald Reagan took down in 1985, you know, because he wanted manlier forms of power than that, you know? And seeing that made me realize that at bottom, this is a problem of political will, not technological know-how. We could have been doing all this for a very long time, and the reason that we're not, more than anything else, is the financial power of the fossil fuel industry to keep us from changing. They are by far the most profitable business the world has ever engaged in. Exxon last year made more money than any company in the history of money. Okay? And it takes a relatively small percentage of that money to warp our political process to keep it from changing. That explains far more than anything else why we have a perfect 20-year bipartisan record of accomplishing absolutely nothing on global warming in Washington. Their business model is simple. We get to use the atmosphere as an open sewer into which to dump our main waste product, carbon, for free. That's why they're so profitable. Nobody else gets that sweetheart business deal. No restaurant in Portland is allowed at the end of the night to just shovel all its garbage out into the middle of the street and leave it. Okay? If they were, they'd make more money. They'd be more profitable. But they would also soon, you know, the city would be overrun with rats. And you'd have to, you know, be dealing with leptospirosis and things. And that's exactly why we don't allow it to happen and why 100 years ago we started insisting that people take care of their waste. But we don't insist upon that with the fossil fuel industry. And they spend large amounts of money to make sure that no one ever will insist on it. Because they're so powerful, the strategy that environmentalists have used for 20 years to try and make progress on this probably isn't really ever going to quite work. The strategy, which made perfect rational sense, was basically to have our scientific leaders sit down with our political leaders and explain over and over and over again that the most dangerous thing the world had ever seen was in the process of happening and that they needed to take action. Okay? And that's how it should work. You know, if the greatest scientists in the world say, look, we're driving off a cliff, then the job of political leaders is to turn the wheel and keep us from going off. But while the scientists were talking rationally in one ear, the fossil fuel industry was bellowing in the other ear, threats and promises. And they drowned out that noise and prevented action, and they had the money to make those threats and promises stick. So we're going to have to figure out, if we're going to make progress, some other currency in which to work. Because we're never going to match them in money, so it's going to have to be something else, passion and spirit and creativity. And that's what I want to talk about for just a moment here. I want to talk about organizing, movement building. It's not something I know an immense amount about. It's not what I set out in my life to do. In fact, just the opposite. I'm a writer. Writers are people who are self-selected to want to sit in their room and type. Okay, it is hard for us to get up on stages and talk to people and go out and have meetings. And, you know, I took my, someone had me take the other day on the line one of those Briggs-Meyer or whatever it's called, personality tests. And I was off the introverted end of the chart, you know? I mean, it was painful. But in the last few years, we've done our best to figure out how to organize and make a difference. I'll just tell you quickly the story about 350.org. In the winter of 2008, well, we'd actually, in the fall of 2007, which came after the summer with the huge, great Arctic ice melt and really just panicked scientists calling me all the time and things. And we decided we were going to have to try to do global organizing, which is a ludicrous thing to even imagine because the globe is a huge place, and also because everyone insists on speaking their own language, which makes it very hard to organize. But we wanted to try to do it. I called up my friend Jim Hansen at NASA and said, you know what? Since we're going to have to work across language boundaries, we can't use words, we're going to need numbers. What's the number? How much carbon is too much? And he said, you know, I've been wondering that same thing myself. And he and his team spent a few months producing a paper that came out in January of 2008, maybe the most important scientific paper of the millennia to date. And what it said was that any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million was too much. In fact, they said, see if I can quote it still, said, any value than that, greater than that is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Okay, so that's strong language. And stronger still, if you know, as I told you earlier, that we're already at 392 parts per million. We're already too high. And so to read that was a kick in the teeth, in a sense. It meant we're never going to solve global warming. We're just going to keep it from getting worse than it otherwise would. Okay, we're fighting not for the world that we knew, but to prevent a world that we can't imagine. But the number was good, because we said to ourselves, at least we'll be able to take this Arabic numeral and we'll mean the same thing every place, you know, in Maine and in Moscow and in Mongolia and wherever else. We'll be able to speak the same language. And that was good that we had that advantage, because we didn't have too much else. The we, in this case, was me and seven people your age, seven seniors at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach a little. They were seniors, so they weren't done with school, but they were done with school, if you know what I mean. And seven was actually a very good number, because there are, in fact, seven continents, so each one of them took one. And the one that took the Antarctic also had to take the internet, you know, because it's kind of its own continent. And off we went, and we tried to organize. We tried to find people like ourselves around the world. You know, they're not environmentalists everywhere, but everywhere there's someone concerned with public health, with hunger, with war and peace and social justice and development, all the things you can't do. I mean, all the things no one's working on in Thailand right now, because they're still trying to, you know, drain people's homes and keep them, you know, heads undercover and so on. Those are the people we found. And we said to them, well, if we didn't know what we were doing, and we said, we're going to just try to have a sort of day that's a kind of coming out party for this number, you know, try to injected into the bloodstream of the planet so that people, more than anything else, understand from it that we're already too high, that global warming's not some future abstract problem, but something happening right now all around us. And we did training camps for young people in Turkey, for Central Asia, in the Caribbean, and we did one in Johannesburg. We brought a couple of kids from every country in Africa down to Johannesburg. Most had never left their country before, been on an airplane, but they were fantastic organizers, and they all fanned out across Africa and Asia and every place else. And we knew they were working. We didn't know how, you know, you can't just Skype everybody all the time easily in every place in the world. So we didn't know exactly what was going on. But we told everybody October 24th, 2009, that would be the first day when we would do this. And we got the sense that it might work 2 days early, October 22nd. We're sitting in the office, in a little borrowed office in Manhattan, around one room with a table and eight of us there with our laptops open, tapping away press releases and things. And the phone rings, and it's a bad satellite phone connection from Ethiopia. And there's a 17-year-old girl on the phone, Lily, one of these girls. She and her sister had come down to South Africa, her 18-year-old sister, and they were our organizing team in the country of Ethiopia. And Lily was in tears, pretty much, and she said, the government's taken away our permit for Saturday for our big rally. So we're doing it today before they can stop us, and we're so sorry. We don't mean to jump the gun. We don't want to spoil it for people. We were so looking forward to doing it at the same time as everybody else, and there are 15,000 people out in the street right now in Addis Ababa chanting 350. And so I was like, Lily, don't worry about the date. It's okay. And, you know. And after that, the pictures just flowed in from all around the world for the next 72 hours or so. There are about 5,100 of these demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN said it was the most widespread day of political activity in the planet's history. And that was the second one, was from U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. 350 with sandbags said, we're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking, you know. I'll just flip through a few of these, just mainly because I want you to see who your brothers and sisters are around the world who are working on these things. And the thing that I want you most to notice about, because the thing that struck me, was that this trope I have heard 1,000 times in my life, that environmentalism is something for rich white people who have taken care of their other problems, and if you had to worry about where your next meal was coming from, you wouldn't be an environmentalist. It's simply not true. Most of the people that we work with around the world are poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world is made up of. And oddly, they are every bit as concerned with the future as anybody else. Maybe more so, because the future bears down hard on you in those categories. And so there's pictures coming from places I'd never heard of. And we had 300 big demonstrations across India. There's the India Youth Climate Network. And places we couldn't identify. There's some place in Buddhist Asia. And places that were really poor. That's someplace on the Congo River above Kinshasa. They didn't even have a digital camera. They tried to develop the picture in someone's home darkroom. It obviously didn't come out so well, so they wrote in what their banner had said. But it just moved me to pieces to see people in, you know, that's what Conrad called the heart of darkness in his slightly Eurocentric way once upon a time. But there they were, you know, and the same all over the world. Huge involvement and beautiful and creative. That's from the Space Needle in Seattle. That's the colors of the Venezuelan flag. That's, hopefully they didn't stop for too long. Amazing images, and some of them really beautiful. One of the things that was really great was to see faith communities deeply involved for the first time in something like this. There's the head of Muslim South Africa, next to him the head of kind of indigenous traditions behind in the scarlet, Archbishop Tutu's successor as Anglican Archbishop, at the head of a huge multi-faith march across Cape Town, Pentecostal school. There's the most important evangelical college in America, a place where a few years ago there would not have been an environmental demonstration, but it was very good to see it happening. I'd been to Bethlehem to do some organizing, hard place to get to, because there's a lot of checkpoints and things in the way. But the Dead Sea is shrinking very rapidly as temperatures rise, and people wanted to do something. There were too many military barriers to get across, so the Jordanians said, we'll make the three on our shore, and the Palestinians said, we'll do the five in Palestine, and the Israelis said, we'll do the zero on our beach. And it was a beautiful thing, and a reminder that it might be a good idea to put aside some of our other concerns every once in a while to deal with the ones that really overpower us. And we get a lot of that kind of global scrabble going on, you know, big numbers. And we looked for iconic places, so in India, palaces, but it was an autumn Saturday in America, so, you know, there's the Syracuse cheerleaders helping us out in front of 100,000 people at Syracuse, and, you know, just everywhere around the world, place after place, including all around Maine, just beautiful, beautiful stuff going on. There's a lot of good climbers that you can, there's the banner, you can see how big it is now, find it there on the wall of the canyon, you know. Soweto, heartland of resistance to apartheid, they did 350 bungee jumps that day, but the best part of it was that they strung the bungee line between the cooling towers of a defunct coal-fired power plant, and they sent a note just saying, this is the best use for coal-fired power plants going forward, and they were absolutely right. There's my daughter in there someplace, you know, in our sap buckets, because our eastern forest will not fare well in this. 300 big demonstrations across China. Not an easy place to do this. One of them got busted up by the police, but most went okay. Those are the China Youth Climate Network making a human wind turbine, and if you look carefully behind them, you can see the edge of the largest wind field on the planet, you know. Place after place after place. Our friends in the Maldives, the most magnificent country involved in this in the whole world. Beautiful place, paradise, 1,200 islands strung across the equator in the Indian Ocean, white sand beaches, a culture that stretches back 5,000 years. The highest point in the archipelago is about a meter above sea level. Okay, the odds of that 5,000 becoming 5,100 are slim. But they're doing everything they can. By 2020, they'll be the first carbon-neutral nation on Earth. They are building windmills and things as fast as they can, even though they're a poor country. And they're doing all the kind of... There's the Student Government Association holding its meeting in the lagoon to demonstrate the problem, you know? Amazing place, entirely Muslim nation, completely involved in this work. And well, they should shame us all a little bit. With their work. And it was a beautiful day, and it was the lead story on Google News for 36 hours, partly because we were in interesting places, but mostly because the people who were involved didn't look like what other people thought environmentalists looked like, you know? That zero in that picture from Yemen, that's all women in full black burqa, you know? It doesn't look like Sierra Club, you know, at their meeting. But that's the point. They're just as, you know. And I confess that there was a file of 600 or 700 pictures just labeled 350 adorable. And they really were adorable. And they really were bittersweet, too. You know. At the beginning of the 19th century, no one could look at... There were going to be bloody wars and refugees and things, but no one in, you know, 1912 could sit and predict who 50 years later were going to be the refugees unless we got our act together, and that's what we can do without any problem here. So it was a beautiful day, and it helped. We got to Copenhagen, the big climate conference, 6 weeks later. It's a lot of momentum. And we convinced 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target. So that was good. You know, from 7 college kids for a couple years of work, it was nice. The trouble is they were the wrong 117 nations. They were all the poor ones. The rich ones, the addicts, led by us, weren't yet ready to do anything. So that conference fizzled. And then Nothing happened. The U.S. Senate wouldn't even bring itself to take a vote on the most mild, tepid climate legislation you could imagine that next summer. They were so scared of the fossil fuel industry, they wouldn't even vote. And I was worried all this movement would fall apart. People would just be so depressed. But happily, people are made of sterner stuff than I. And we've had two more of these big global days of action, and they've just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. The last one this last fall we called Moving Planet, and it was all about transportation. And there were people on bicycles in huge numbers in pretty much everywhere, every country on Earth involved except North Korea. And it's all great and powerful and just that kind of currency that we need to be working in, spreading the word. And it's also not enough because of that power in the fossil fuel industry that's so hard to break. So we need other kinds of currencies too. And sometimes we need to spend our bodies even. And I'll just tell briefly the story of this work over the last 6 or 8 months about this fight over this Keystone pipeline thing out of Alberta. 6 or 8 months ago, nobody really had heard of it. I hadn't really heard of it. But then again, Jim Hansen at NASA said to me one day, you know, there's a lot of carbon up there in those tar sands. That's the second biggest pool of carbon on Earth. If you could burn it all tonight, which happily you can't, but if you could, we would take the atmosphere's carbon concentration from 390 parts per million to 540 parts per million just from that one deposit. Okay? He said, if you tap into it heavily, it's essentially game over for the climate. And so that got us to work. And the place we went to work was this proposed pipeline that would start really opening up those tar sands to exploitation. And we rallied against it. And we knew that, you know, we knew that the other guys were going to win unless we were able to really raise its profile. And so we did what I thought we needed to do. A bunch of us went to Washington and did civil disobedience and got arrested. Over 2 weeks, there were 1,253 people. There were 1,253 people put in jail. It was the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country. And it was really beautiful. I got to see all of it except for the 3 days when I was in jail. I got to watch it, you know, it all every day. And I told people earlier, one of the things we told people was, it should not be young people, college kids, that have to carry this burden. Should be mostly those of us older, because we've spent our lives pouring carbon into the atmosphere, and because, and I really mean this, guys, if you're 18 right now, you know, an arrest record is probably in our economy not going to be your greatest asset, okay? But once you've reached a certain age, what the hell are they going to do to you, you know? I mean, it's like there are few enough things that get easier with age, but that kind of calculation is one of them. And so it was great. We didn't ask people how old they were. That would be rude. We asked them, who was president when you were born? And the biggest cohorts came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay, so that was good. And we also told everybody, if you're coming, wear a necktie or put on a dress. Because we really want to demonstrate the truth of this matter, which is that we are not the radicals here. Not at all. We're trying to conserve the world in something like the fashion that we knew it when we were born. Radicals work at oil companies. They are willing to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere in order to make money. That is the most radical thing that any human being has ever done. Alter the chemical composition of the one atmosphere that we have. It is crazy radical. And yet, because they have a lot of money, we think of it as normal. At any rate, those arrests, we spent our bodies well. We were kind of anteed up in this game and raised the profile enough that suddenly a lot of people started hearing about it. And then we circled the White House 5 deep in people. And indeed, Having raised its profile, we were able to convince the administration that it was a good idea to take more time and review it more carefully. And they agreed to do that, and that was right. And they did that in November, but in December, the Congress went to work. And we think of the Congress as the most, democratic part of our, small d, democratic part of our government, the place where we should have the most access and, so on and so forth. They didn't hold hearings and have experts in for days and try to figure out what was going on with this. They voted 234 to 193 to speed up consideration of the pipeline, and those 234 people who wanted to expedite this thing, between them had taken $42 million from the fossil fuel industry for their campaigns. That's wrong. I know that it's like realistic and how things get done. It's still wrong, and we've got to stop it. I was saying to people earlier today, I gave a little talk at the Portland courthouse today because there was a little demonstration to mark the second anniversary of that Citizens United thing, that sort of opened up fully the money spigots for corporate America and interfere in our political life. And I said, this is just, it's cheating. If the Patriots make the Super Bowl and Bob Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, is caught giving money to the referees beforehand, it's a national scandal. Everybody is be outraged. But if Exxon does it, then it's okay. That's crazy, and we've got to stop it. Right now, last week, the Congress told the president that he had to make a decision within 60 days, which was ludicrous because they don't even have a route yet for the pipeline. How are you supposed to evaluate it? And so the president, quite bravely the other day, said, no, we're going to deny the permit for this thing. It was brave because 3 or 4 days before, the American Petroleum Institute had issued the most naked of threats. The head of it, this is, Mr. Big Oil, said, do this and we will exact huge political consequences, quote unquote. So Barack Obama did not just the right thing, but the brave thing. They have... And I say that as someone who's obviously not a big sort of knee-jerk partisan. I got arrested outside the guy's house. Okay, but this was good. But today they're back at it. They're going to attach it to the next payroll tax hike. Because they don't work for us. They work for the oil industry. That's who employs them. Okay, if you take money, think about what it means to take money from someone, okay? If you at Christmas time, got a present from someone who you didn't give one to, you'd forgotten or something, you felt bad, and you felt, and that's like for a pair of socks, If someone gives you $100,000 for your campaign, well, what do you think? We can't afford to keep doing that. And so we're going to have to, we can't afford bad policy decisions year after year that pay no attention to reality, to physics and chemistry. So we're going to have to take that on. And I don't know whether we can win. I don't know whether we'll win on this pipeline, even if we win for right now. It's a temporary victory. All environmental victories are temporary. And stopping one pipeline doesn't stop that much. We're going to have to do bigger, deeper change. And I don't know whether we can. I wish I could guarantee to you that all of this was going to work. And I can't. There are scientists who think that we waited too long to get started, that the momentum of this heating is too great to be effectively reversed. The consensus is we still have room not to stop global warming, but at least to prevent it from getting completely out of control. But that window is clearly small and closing. There are political scientists who think it's impossible, that there is too much money on the other side. So far, they've been right. If you were a betting person, you would bet that we weren't going to be able to do anything to beat them. But that's not a bet that you're allowed to make. The price of being a morally awake person when the worst thing that ever happened on the planet is in the process of happening is to get up in the morning and try to figure out what you can do to change those odds, even with no guarantee of victory. Can't guarantee you that we'll win. Can guarantee you, because I've been in motion the last 3 or 4 years all over the planet, that there are people in rooms like this all over the earth trying to figure out what they can do to come together to do something about it. And I know, I guarantee you, that they will fight, and many of them will fight in these countries that have done nothing to cause this problem. And they look very much to us to exert some leadership, because we have real power and real control over much of what happens. So I don't know how it's going to end. I do know that it's going to be a fight, and I do know that I look forward to doing it, fighting it shoulder to shoulder with y'all and seeing how it comes out. And I thank you enormously for coming here tonight and listening to me. Thank you. Now I can see you.
That's good.
Yeah, close. Now I've... As is often the case, okay. I fear I've rattled on longer than I should, but Anwar, do we still have... We have time for some questions from here and from those...
Yes. Yes, we do.
Far-flung points across Maine, yes?
So. Yes, we do. And those who want to ask questions, could you please line up on this side of the lecture hall, and we'll try to accommodate as many people as possible.
Okay. My question is about methane.
Stop this.
It's generally thought that coal is the worst in terms of greenhouse emissions. And I'm guessing that's not true, because it seems to me that the extraction of natural gas is very poorly executed. And they say that it's the cleanest burning fuel, but of course, that's only a half truth, because you've got to extract it. So my guess is that there's a lot of methane being leaked while they extract the natural gas, and then that is the worst fuel that we can pursue.
So this is a very interesting question, and let's back up and just think about energy in general right now. We've essentially run out of the easy stuff, okay? When people talk about peak oil, that's what they mean. There's no longer, Saudi Arabia is running dry. We're no longer able to count on that kind of easy stuff. What we should have done once we figured that out was say, okay, that means we really should go to work, not just because of global warming, but for lots of reasons. We should deeply, quickly go to work on this renewable transition. But instead, what we've tended to do is say, this means we should quickly try to find what hydrocarbons we can around the planet. And so we have, for instance, we've gone after extreme energy. We've done deep sea drilling, we've done mountaintop removal, we've done tar sands, and we do this, what you would call fracking for natural gas. Exploding things a mile or so beneath the surface, exploding small bombs, really, to fracture the subsurface geology so more gas will leak out. And your suspicion is correct about what it is that's, you know, what results when that happens. We don't actually really know all the details yet because no one studied it. We're just going ahead and doing it. But the first studies indicate that you release enough methane. When you burn methane, it's cleaner than coal. But if you release it, CH4, if you release it directly into the atmosphere, if some of it leaks out, then it's much more potent molecule for molecule greenhouse gas.
20 times more potent.
Yeah, or more, depending on how you measure the, you know, the over what time frame you're interested in. I'm just trying to find a couple of numbers here.
My guess is that when they frack, they're not collecting it all, and it's leaking.
Yes, so the first studies seem to indicate that that's the case, and that, in fact, it's at least as dirty as coal. The point is that we can't make any of these calculations about what we should do rationally because we don't have any price on carbon or other greenhouse gases to reflect the damage that they do. And because of that, we end up doing things that turn out to be crazy. You would not go near the tar sands if you had a price on carbon because it wouldn't pay. It would be too expensive to do. So the fight against... We need to fight all these things piece by piece. Let's stop fracking. Let's stop this pipeline. Let's do all that. It's very important to do. But we really can't. We're like the little Dutch boy in the leaking dike, you know, and we're way out of fingers. We've got to figure out how to attack it systemically. And that's why, you know, that's why increasingly we're doing our work around this money and politics stuff. We'll be up on Capitol Hill on Tuesday with 500 or 1,000 people in referees' shirts, okay, blowing the whistle on Congress, pointing out that we have to change the series of subsidies that we give to fossil fuel industries, and the biggest of that subsidy is the right to just use the atmosphere as an open sewer.
The price on carbon wouldn't even solve this problem because this is unburnt methane.
Well, the price on greenhouse gases would solve this problem. Right. And if there was a price on carbon, we would not be going after natural gas in that way. If you want to get involved in this, now I should have said this earlier, and I'm very technologically unoriented. I mean, you can go to 350.org and just sign up. But for those of you who are cell phone carriers, if you turn them back on now, and I know you politely turned them off before, but I'm testing, I haven't done this before, but I kind of want to test it. Where I live, cell phones don't even work, so I don't even really, you know, it's outside my ken, but that makes me in a tiny percentage of the world's population now, because no matter where you get, you know, back of beyond in Bangladesh or something, people have cell phones. Well, if you text to this number, 50555, if you text the word, it's not really a word, but it's close to a word, if you text the word plug-in, all one word, P-L-U-G-I-N, plug-in, to that number, then you'll be on the list to get the kind of action updates and things from 350.org so we can keep track of you and put you to work, because everybody's got to work. That's the problem, and that's the opportunity. We need you in this fight. And as I said before, we need you in this fight, old or young, okay? Because everybody's got things they can bring to it now. And it's powerful and moving to see that happen.
Hello, my name is Sally Holmes, and I go to school in Waterville at Colby College. and I was wondering, in terms of developing countries, what are your views on paying for methods of transitioning away from energies that contribute to climate change?
That's a very, very good question. So, if the single biggest problem that we have in making this transition is the power of the fossil fuel industry, the second biggest is the gulf between rich and poor countries, okay? Because there's a lot of places that are very poor and where the easiest way to become slightly less poor would be to do exactly what we did, which is burn up, you know, d- dig up the coal that's lying all over the world and burn it, okay? And it's not sufficient to say to them, sorry, we've already filled the atmosphere, you find something else to, you know, because unlike us, they actually, at the moment, they can't really afford to just skip straight to, I mean, it makes great sense to take them straight to solar energy or whatever, because they tend to be equatorial and because they don't have the built infrastructure that we do already. It would make, just as it made great sense to go straight to cell phones instead of installing telephone poles. But financially, we have to be there helping. It's both our moral and our practical duty, having become rich burning fossil fuel, to take some small percentage of that. And a pretty small percentage. I mean, you know, supposedly the fund that will be set up beginning in 2020 by the international community will be $100 billion a year to help all the poor countries of the world. But so far, no one stepped up to, you know, find out where that money's coming from. When Citibank needs money, we step up and figure it out, okay? But when we have money for problems on an almost unimaginably larger scale where people would really be helped, we're not doing that yet. And it's one of the things we really need to work on, and it's probably the most important thing that we try to do at these endless series of international conferences like the one that just ended in Durban. The progress has been small, and I think it's probably one of the most important reasons that we work hard to elect generous and open-minded people to public office in this country, because we're going to need to go back to being a little generous and open to the rest of the world in the years ahead.
Hi, Bill. My name is Meg Wolf. In the recent years, we've been hearing the slogan, veganism is the new Prius. Could you address moving towards a more plant-based diet for the health of the planet?
Sure. I think my old friend Michael Pollan is exactly right. What's his slogan? Not too much, mostly plants. I think it makes great sense. I also don't think you need to be overly fanatic about it. One of the things, I spend a lot of time out in the rest of the world, and there are lots and lots of places in the world where people, one of the things that they really desire is to every once in a while have a little bit of meat with dinner, because they haven't, they don't get much and it tastes good and whatever. And I don't think that's to be frowned on. In fact, I think it's a lot to be learned from. If you're going to eat, one way to think about it is to say, if you're going to eat meat, not only should you go find good meat from good farmers doing good things in your neighborhood, but you should, tend to eat it the way that people do in the rest of the world, which is in small amounts as a kind of flavoring for kind of condiments, not the kind of large honking slab culinary technique that we have favored in this country, there's always a danger with environmentalism, as with many other things, of being overly dogmatic and turning people off. And so it's good not to do that too. As I said before, I think that the secret is to have more fun than other people have, and part of that involves, eating delicious, good things close to home. And frankly, I think we may have reached the point where I'm going to stop so I can go eat some of them. Thank you all.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was author and environmentalist Bill McKibben. He recently spoke at the University of New England in Westbrook. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Bill McKibben, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to access this program, in addition to many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.